Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. The only successful coup d'etat in this nation's history occurred right here in North Carolina in 1898. It happened in Wilmington, where a mob of white supremacists murdered at least 22 black citizens, estimates run as high as 300, and overthrew the city's democratically elected biracial government. For more than a century afterwards, the coup was mislabeled as a riot, and few people even knew it had occurred. Over the past decade, documentaries, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, and in-depth historical research have made the murderous 1898 racial attack better known. A new book by a journalist and Wilmington native builds on those efforts and expands the story by recounting what led up to the coup and how it reverberates to this day. The author's name is Lauren Collins, and she is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her book is They Stole a City, Wilmington's White Supremacist Coup and the Families Who Live with Its Legacy. Lauren, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here with you, Eric.
Well, let's begin with your beginning. You were born in Wilmington in 1980, and you grew up there, but it wasn't until 2016, after you had become a journalist, that you learned of the 1898 massacre, or at least learned of it in detail. What were race relations like in your hometown as you grew up?
Well, as you said, I was, born in Wilmington in 1980. I was a senior in high school at New Hanover High School, which comes up in significant ways in the book, in 1998, when the centennial of the massacre and coup rolled around, and the first commemorations and really attempts to look somewhat squarely in the face of this legacy started happening. So in 1998, we weren't learning about this in school. There's been some progress made since then in education on 1898, although I think there could be more. But the community was taking these kinds of first steps towards thinking about what confronting this history would look like. However, this was an incredibly sensitive issue, one that was subject both to private reticence in families and basically to public omerta for a long time. So when word went around that the city and some of the kind of big wigs in town would be organizing a commemoration, some people in the community thought that it might be a celebration. That was the atmosphere of kind of suppression of truth and just fear and secrecy around it that was happening when I was growing up in Wilmington.
I mentioned 2016. That's when you wrote a story about Christopher Everett and his documentary, Wilmington on Fire. You wrote a short profile of him after spending time in Wilmington with him. And I'm wondering what it was like to be back in your hometown, but seeing the city in such a different way.
It really opened my eyes. Chris's documentary is fantastic. I saw it, and that was the first time that I really got a glimpse of the larger history of 1898. You mentioned that my book is building on the work of others. I also want to shout out David Zucchino's fantastic 2020 book, Wilmington's Lie. I watched Chris's movie and I thought more people have got to know this story. Let me use whatever kind of little platform I have at The New Yorker just to spread the word. And so, as you said, I wrote a short story, but as part of that, I met up with Chris in Wilmington to interview him, and we went down to the 1898 memorial. And so we're standing there, and I'm reading this plaque, which gives, it's It's accurate, but it gives the story of 1898 in very neat terms, kind of all tied up with a bow and dots the I's and crosses the T's, and explained that this event was, you know, sent a message of impunity nationwide and was instrumental in the solidifying of Jim Crow. And so I'm reading that very official story. And then I look and I see that someone has made this other sign, homemade, guerrilla effort. It's on plywood and they've climbed up a telephone pole and nailed it there. And it says in big painted letters, 1898 war crime. And when I saw that, I realized that this was a live wire, that this history was still alive, that it had really high stakes for people living today, that it was still being adjudicated. And so I was also convinced that, you know, it was behind a lot of the kind of, you know, some of the sense of unease that I had felt growing up there. So anyway, I thought, I really want to know more about this. And I want to get to the bottom of what I just saw.
And you went on to spend 10 years writing They Stole a City, which has just been published. You decided to make four families, two white and two black, the focus of this history, and you follow perpetrators and victims through multiple generations. How did you hit upon that structure?
This is a multi-generational saga. As I said, I thought, you know, what can I do to move the ball forward? And I actually had this kind of like post-it note, and I wrote on it, America's only coup, and then what? And I stuck it to my desk and I looked at it every day over the course of those 10 years. So I really wanted to go back both further into the past, further in history, and show the forces that were leading up to this event. And then to take it down the line of the generations and show the cumulative and the compounding damage. And I thought that the best way to do this was by looking at families, because families are a means of transmission. And I also wanted to grapple absolutely with the quantitative consequences of 1898, but look at some of the qualitative consequences too. What did people lost life, they lost property, they lost jobs, but they also lost belonging and they lost home and they lost love. And so I just thought that families would be the right lens for exploring some of those issues that I wanted to get into.
And during the time you were working on this book, as I mentioned earlier, another documentary came out, the American Experience account of 1898. And then you mentioned David Zucchino's Wilmington's Lie, the Pulitzer Prize winning book. And I'm wondering whether those projects affected how you approached what you were doing, gave you pause in any way that there would be too much Wilmington in the world, so to speak?
No, I mean, you know, I feel like I'm building on that work. I don't know. The way I look at this is that this is an important, you know, a really critical story that every American needs to know. And until we've accomplished that goal, I don't think there can be too much. But I think this work belongs in many hands, and mine is one set. And yeah, what I really wanted to look at was this event in its longitudinal fullness through multiple generations of families.
That's the voice of Lauren Collins. Her new book is called They Stole a City. Before we get to the painful repercussions of the 125 years since the coup, let's set the stage for what was obscured for so long. Wilmington in 1898 stands as the most successful and last remnant of Reconstruction after the Civil War. Black men serve at the highest levels of local government. There is a significant class of doctors, lawyers, educators, and other professionals filled by black residents, and an effective political alliance known as Fusion that pairs black voters and white Republicans. And as you've pointed out before, Republicans and Democrats kind of had an opposite political philosophy at this time. So how did all of that get torn down and who tore it down?
Okay, so Fusion was a multiracial working class coalition that brought together mostly white populists and mostly Black Republicans, the party of Lincoln at the time, together in common class interests. And it was this unprecedented experiment in interracial political cooperation. In 1898, Fusionists controlled Wilmington city government. Three of the 10 aldermen were Black. And Wilmington, as one historian put it, was the heart of Black political power in the state. So it was a bastion of possibility. And that, you know, was not attractive to the Democrats, who in 1898 were leading a statewide campaign on white supremacy. The Fusionists had swept the 1896 elections. So in 1898, the Democrats say, all right, we want to get back in power. We want to take power back. How are we going to do that? And they launched an explicit campaign of white supremacy. They were trying to break up this interracial coalition.
And to be clear, we still don't know how many Black Wilmingtonians were murdered that day, and no one was ever prosecuted or punished for these crimes either.
We don't know for sure, and we probably never will. A 2002 report put the number at 22 deaths. I think it's likely much higher. Some bodies were never found. Others were likely quietly buried. And you also have to remember, we haven't gotten into this just yet, but Wilmington's Black newspaper had just been torched and burned to the ground. So there was nowhere to memorialize the Black dead. We know 8 of their names. We also know that at least 21 men were run out of town and, you know, warned never to set foot in Wilmington again on the pain of death. And along with them went this whole diaspora of diverted potential and unresolved grief. So in 1898, you had a population that was 56% Black in Wilmington. And by 1900, just 2 years after the massacre and coup, that has decreased to 49%.
And now it's 11%.
Yes. It has continued to dwindle as the years have gone by for a number of reasons.
But that's one of the many examples, and we'll get into this as the conversation goes on, of how this reverberates, of how the cascading effects from November 10th, 1898 can still be felt.
Exactly.
Well, that is a world-class teaser as we go from 1898 to 2026. We're going to pick that back up. We're speaking with Lauren Collins. Her new book is called They Stole a City, Wilmington's White Supremacist Coup and the Families Who Live with Its Legacy. Stay right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Lauren Collins. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She grew up in Wilmington, and her new book is about the 1898 massacre and coup by white supremacists. It's called They Stole a City. Lauren, you write in the book that you finished this project, quote, understanding that November 10th, 1898 is a centuries-long day that isn't over yet, end quote. What did you mean by that? How is it not over yet?
What I meant when I wrote that was that I wanted to make an accounting of the longitudinal cumulative effects of this massacre and coup. So, you know, something I think is a little bit different about this book, often when we look at 1898, the story stops there. Once the white supremacists have marched to City Hall and overthrown the government. And at the outer limit, sometimes it stops in 1900 when they achieve their aim of evicting Black men from political life by passing a grandfather clause in the North Carolina state constitution. But when I started researching this, I realized that the story actually went on much longer. And so I look at Jim Crow. I look at the botched desegregation of Wilmington schools. You know, I want to say in the 1950s, but that is not what happened. It wasn't until the 1960s, with a lot of legal maneuvering, that that started. And it culminated in the closure of Williston Senior High School, Wilmington's beloved bastion of Black education. I look at the wrongful prosecution of the Wilmington 10, who weren't issued pardons of innocence until 2013. I look at voter suppression attempts. I look at gerrymandering. A lot of what we're seeing now has very deep roots, you know, much earlier in our nation and in our state's history. So I think 1898 is 21st century history as much as 19th century history. I think it's white history as much as Black history. And I really wanted to try to make a full accounting of what it meant, because I think it's the only way that there's a possibility of making, you know, Wilmington and speaking in a larger sense, communities like it whole again.
One of the things you just mentioned in that answer is this grandfather clause. A man named George Rountree was responsible for that. Explain to people what that grandfather clause did.
The grandfather clause basically said that if your grandfather could vote before the Civil War, so could you. And if he couldn't, then you couldn't either. And so this was kind of a legal maneuver. It was like some legal trickery that essentially that the effect was to exclude Black men in very vast numbers from political life. And so, you know, the white supremacists in 1898, first they imposed their will by fire and by machine gun. And then they set about sort of completing it with pen and ink. So yes, the grandfather clause disenfranchised the vast majority of Black men, and it accomplished the white supremacist goal of evicting Black men from political life. So by 1902, fewer than 5% of Black North Carolinians are on the electoral rolls.
And you write that, and people who have been in the state will remember this, that after that grandfather clause is passed in 1899, I believe, it wasn't until 1992 that a Black congressman was elected in North Carolina again.
Right. That was Eva Clanton in 1992. And I was 12 years old when that happened. So the white supremacist's stated intention was to make it so, and I'm quoting here, so that, you know, no Black man, of course, it was all men at the time, could ever hold office, political office in North Carolina again. And they succeeded for quite a while after 1898.
And of course, this comes right up to the present, 2026, not only with some of the things going on at the Supreme Court, with the Voting Rights Act, with Southern districts for Congress, but also North Carolina, which has to be, if not the foremost state with legal challenges over access to voting, it's in the top five.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Voting Rights Act and the challenges to voting. after the white supremacists, you know, killed people in the streets and overthrew the government, they dressed, I mean, there was, you know, it was this shabby, thuggish thing that they dressed up in grandiloquent terms. They called it the Wilmington Revolution, as though they had been an oppressed people rising up against tyranny. And when I was reading, you know, you can see some of the same maneuvers, I think, at work in Louisiana versus Calais, for example. Again, there's this need for legalistic cover for this high-flown language, when in fact the goal is the same as it was in 1898, which is to take the vote and thus power away from Black people.
And one of the things, one of the many things that you write about is the white mob that carried out the attacks was made up of some of the most prominent people in Wilmington, almost all of whom benefited from murdering, beating, and cheating their Black neighbors. One of the ringleaders was Alfred Moore Waddell, who was appointed mayor right after the coup. And you mentioned earlier this idea of trying to calculate all of the damage from what Waddell and others did. Has anyone even come up with an estimate of what kind of cost this was, not just in lives, but in wealth and homeownership and all the other things that were wiped away?
I don't think it's possible to put a number on it. And a lot of that, or at least it's not, I do not have the capacity to put a number on it. But I think what's really important to remember is the perpetrators of this coup, like you said, were not marginal people or just a few bad apples. They were putatively the pillars of society in Wilmington and the pillars of a political party, of the church, of the military, of the business, of the press. And so not only did they do this thing, but they had a lot of power and for a long time almost a monopoly in shaping how it was talked about afterwards. The white elite version of this was that it was a good thing for the city, and it was also relatively minor and quick. And so, you know, when people ask, why didn't people know about 1898? One big reason is that, like, for example, the local historical society was led for many, many years in Wilmington by the grandson of one of the leaders of 1898. So it was just this very, like, move along, there's nothing to see here. And just because the perpetrators of the coup were proud of what they did, it doesn't mean that they were honest about it. In New Orleans, for example, after the massacre of 1866, an inquest was commissioned fairly quickly. In Wilmington, no such formal investigation took place until 2000.
Which is incredible. And a couple of points come to mind based on what you just said. One of them is the way this has been remembered, which is such a big part of your story. Alfred Moore Waddell, who I just mentioned, who's one of the leading perpetrators of this, goes on to become mayor. Well, he dies in 1912. He's 77 years old. So it's been, 15 years, 14 years since this occurred. And the flags fly at half mast to honor his contributions to civic life. So there, not only is there not punishment, there's celebration.
Absolutely. And so many of the perpetrators, Alfred Moore Waddell is a perfect example. John Dillard Bellamy Jr., who was knee deep in it, when he died, and I think this was in the 40s or the 50s, we can check, but well into the 20th century, he was memorialized in the New York Times as the grandee, you know, the great man of the North Carolina bar. And 1898 didn't even come up. So yes, I mean, most of these guys finished out their lives with this kind of halo surrounding them. And the truth didn't come out until much later.
Your book is dedicated to a woman named Cynthia Brown, who is a descendant of one of the Black families that lived through this. But before we talk about her story, I'm curious, how were you received by the descendants of the two white families who were involved in the worst side of this?
I was surprised. You know, when at the outset of this, I didn't know who would want to talk to me. And even once we talked, to what extent, you know, just how honest the conversation would be. There were, of course, and are, of course, people who want nothing to do with this. But there are also a lot of people who are making efforts to confront this past and whose attitudes towards it have changed even in the course of the time I spent writing the book. So I thought it was really important. I mean, obviously the white families who are in the book are families, or at least there are members of the families who were willing to exchange with me to some extent and to talk to me about their stories. But I thought it was really important to try to answer a question that Toni Morrison posed in her essay, Black Matters. And that was, what is the impact of racism on people who perpetrate it? So I wanted to get into that in addition to a number of other questions about how the memory and the truth or lack thereof of this event came down the line in white families. And I am really, really grateful to the people who were willing to talk about it with me, because there are so many people who would rather just turn the other way and not think about it.
I think that's really interesting. You've already mentioned it a couple times, and it's a thread throughout the book, the idea of the perpetrators making peace with what happened with their descendants. You know, obviously they're talking about their descendants. The truth of this, it's something that Bryan Stevenson talks a lot about in terms of not just improving race relations, but improving the health of the country, because acknowledging something obviously makes it much more apparent and gets rid of all of the things that are simmering beneath. Given that, did you find much resistance?
No, not as much as I'd expected. That said, I don't know that the resistance to my project is necessarily coming out and, you know, proclaiming that to me. I think that to confront the past is a really positive thing, and that is what I'm trying to accomplish.
Now, I mentioned Cynthia Brown. She died in 2023. She was part of the Howe family, whose presence in Wilmington dates to the late 1700s. She was five generations removed from three Howe brothers whose construction business was very prominent during Reconstruction. How well did you get to know Cynthia, and how did her memories of her great-grandmother surviving November 10th, 1898 help you understand this history in a more visceral way?
Cynthia was one of the great keepers of this history, and she devoted a large part of her life to making sure that people knew about it and that they knew the real story. I'll tell you a little bit about her family. As you said, the Howes were a prominent family of Black builders. Cynthia's great-grandmother, Athalia Howe Whitfield, survived the 1898 massacre. She watched a white man kill a Black man in the street. She was about 18 at the time. She ran to her church, St. Stephen, and there she watched white men with guns kidnap the pastor. So she was with some family members. They knew that, you know, when they saw that, they knew that they were on their own. And they ran to Pine Forest Cemetery and they took refuge there, probably for several days. And that, you know, it was freezing and it was swampy. And that was another trial. But so Cynthia had heard whispers, you know, kind of intimations of this story, but it was a really hard thing to talk about. And when you read the book, you'll also understand that there were some sensitivities in her family that, you know, that had made it difficult to talk about. But I want to tell you, when she was in high school, she went to the library in Wilmington and she asked for more information about 1898. And it was literally kept under lock and key at the time. So the librarian said to her, well, why do you want to know? And Cynthia answered, and the librarian said that, well, she didn't want to put this in the hands of anybody who would make a stink. And Cynthia left empty-handed. So this was a quest that took her long periods of time. And even in the final months of her life, she was fielding questions and meeting students and doing Zooms. And she was really just put so much energy into making sure that people knew about this story. And so I wanted to pay tribute to her.
And she even was a little bit reluctant when she moved back in the 90s. I think you write about at the start of the book, she's moved back from Chicago with her husband. And she goes to this event with, I think, one of her former teachers and some other people that she had known in Wilmington. And even she's a little hesitant to kind of be dragged into the history. But then, as you say, she embraced it more than anyone.
Exactly. I mean, she got this kind of weird call because it was from her fifth grade teacher who said, hey, we want to invite you to a luncheon. And of course, you know, Cynthia had adored her teacher, but they'd never been peers or friends. And so Cynthia shows up and it's all fancy and they sit down and they eat. And one of the women who is there turns to her and gives her a manuscript that had been written by a relative, a forebear of Cynthia's, about 1898. So, you know, she gets home from the luncheon and she calls her dad and she says, well, I just went to this luncheon and I was given a document. And he says, you know what, Cynthia, I've got a copy too, but I just didn't know when you'd be ready, and it's time now.
With that, it's time for a break for us, and we're going to come back and talk a little bit more with Lauren Collins about Wilmington 1898 and its repercussions. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest is Lauren Collins. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. She grew up in Wilmington, and her new book covers 200 years of racial injustice. It's called They Stole a City. And Lauren, we were just talking about Cynthia Brown, and now I'm going to put us in the fast forward machine and go to a topic that you mentioned earlier, which is the Wilmington 10. This is a boycott that was led by a group of black high school students in Wilmington in 1971, and it made national and international news, but since then, it's really rarely heard of. I can tell you, I've lived in this state 30 plus years, and I knew nothing about this until I read your book. So take us through both what happened and why you think it kind of fell dormant.
I'm glad you mentioned the Wilmington 10. So basically, you know, I mentioned Williston High School. The school board decided to close Williston, which was the cherished bastion of black education in 1968, and to convert it to a middle school. And 1968, I mean, that was how long it took Wilmington to desegregate schools. When the Supreme Court finally ordered that schools had an affirmative duty to desegregate. So the school board decides to close Williston. There's a lot of bad feeling in both the black community and the white community. Essentially, nobody wants this. And the school board had been dragging its feet for years about desegregation. So in 1968, black students lose their school and they are thrust into two white high schools with very little preparation on either side. And so there's a lot of tension that continues. And in 1971, after some of these incidents, Black students decided to lead a boycott. And so they're having kind of an alternative school at a church called Gregory. And essentially, people, it's a white supremacist group called Rope, and people come along and start shooting at them. And Gregory, there ends up being a siege at Gregory, and a lot of fighting back and forth, fires, and a grocery store called Mike's Grocery burns in February 1971. They were originally the Wilmington 11, but by the time they went to trial, one of them had skipped bail. The Wilmington 10 were arrested for having burned Mike's Grocery, but there was really very little evidence. And the trial was marred by all kinds of, you know, misconduct, essentially. So the Wilmington 10 went to jail, and it wasn't until 2013 that the state issued them pardons of innocence, which doesn't mean, you know, the state says we're forgiving you. Pardons of innocence means you never should have been convicted. But four members had already died without redress. And basically, I wanted to kind of connect the dots between the patterns of bad faith, mistrust, miscommunication, escalation, and this idea of white people trying to uphold a racial hierarchy that they'd established in 1898. I wanted to follow them through the century that came. And I thought the Wilmington 10 trial, mistrial, we should say, misprosecution was a very important part of that.
I'm curious what you think of the, if you agree with me, first of all, that this is not a prominent piece of North Carolina history anymore. It's important, but I just don't feel like it's really been talked about that much, that it you know, is even as present as 1898. And is that another symptom of what happened in 1898?
I think it is. I mean, you know, for a while when it was happening, this was very well known. For example, Barbara Walters brought it up with Castro, I believe. And
it was on 60 Minutes. And yeah,
it was on 60 Minutes. And I think it was Khrushchev who said, you know, don't talk to me about human rights when you have the Wilmington 10 in jail in Wilmington. The other thing that was interesting is the Wilmington 10 and their advocates explicitly linked their wrongful prosecution to this white supremacist regime that had been installed in Wilmington in 1898 and never really overthrown or punished or prosecuted in any formal way.
Now, we were talking earlier about, you mentioned 1898 in terms of the plaque and some of the physical remembrances that now exist and the true nature of what happened, that it wasn't a riot, that it was a massacre. In, I believe, 2023, Wilmington held a funeral ceremony for Joshua Halsey. He's one of the eight victims whose names we know. The Reverend Dr. William Barber, who is a North Carolinian, one of the foremost activists for equity right now, delivered the eulogy.
Joshua was murdered by a system, and others like him were murdered by a system. It was not some insane folk. It was very sane people who plotted and planned. And we cannot have a normal funeral as though he and others died a normal death ordained by God. These were violent deaths.
How would you assess our collective reckoning with 1898 to this point?
Well, Reverend Barber's words, Joshua Halsey's funeral was in 2021, and Reverend Barber's words were beacons for me as I wrote this book. I actually used, you know, a quote from that speech as in the beginning of the book. And Reverend Barber said, "The blood of Joshua Halsey still cries, and the question is, can we hear it?" That was an allusion to Genesis, to, you know, the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." And I thought the funeral It was so moving. It was so necessary. And I hope that we will have more of that recognition. I mean, what I would really like to see is more education about 1898. As Reverend Barber says, he looks to the fusion movement as inspiration and as a template for the cross-class and cross-racial movement that he's building. I think we need to take the white supremacist terror threat seriously. I think reparations would be appropriate. Wilmington is a case study for reparations. But most of all, I hope that we can channel the hope of 1898 while heeding, most of all, I hope that we can channel the hope of 1897 while heeding the lessons of 1898.
One of the things that is happening right now that you mentioned toward the end is that the architect for the Smithsonian's National African American Museum has been hired to help design a museum dedicated to 1898 that will be built in Wilmington and I think is tentatively targeted to open in 2 years. What more do you know about that, if anything, and what do you hope to see in that museum?
So the museum is to be called the Wilmington 1898 Museum for Healing, Education, and Democracy. And it is a project that's founded and funded by Lee Carter, who is a white Wilmington native and trauma therapist. And she's brought on, as you said, Zena Howard, who managed the design of the Smithsonian's National Museum. She's brought on some really interesting people to design it on land at 3rd and Davis in Wilmington across the street from the 1898 Memorial Park. And I've talked to Lee a little bit about it, and she said her ambition is to create a world-class institution and for people to have meaningful dialogue and problem-solving discussions from a place of solid historical data. So I hope that that will come to fruition, and we will see that soon, because it would be a wonderful resource, not only for people in Wilmington, but for people who are coming to visit Wilmington from all over.
You mentioned, as we were talking about the Wilmington 10, which happened much later, obviously in 1971, you mentioned a group called ROPE. That was a white supremacy group. ROPE is R-O-W-P, stands for Rights of White People Party. I mention that because I don't think you can say it too often, the brutal and blatant nature of this racism. So you have ROPE. Before that, you had the Klan, and Klan activity in North Carolina was as active, if not more active, than any other part of the South, which I learned through your book. And then when you go back to 1898, leading up to that horrible day, the townspeople drafted the White Declaration of Independence. So I wonder, as you go through this history, how much of this was new to you and how do you process it? Because this is grim stuff.
Well, I think what we have got to remember is that white supremacist violence is a through line of our country's history. It's not a flashback. It's not a regression. It's not a blip. You know, you named all these different groups in different guises. This threat has continued and resurfaced throughout our history. So 1898 to me demonstrates that white supremacists will continue to take what they think is theirs until the consequences of such acts outweigh the spoils. Both the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security have repeatedly identified white nationalists as America's, I quote, most persistent and lethal terrorist threat. So I think we need to take this really seriously. And I think Wilmington is a prime example of what happens when white supremacists are allowed to run unchecked.
You worked on this book, as I mentioned, for 10 years, and you kept your day job at The New Yorker, and you also live in Paris. So I'm wondering, how did you juggle all of these things, working on the book, I assume you had to make some trips to North Carolina to interview people and taking care of your day job from very far from Wilmington.
You forgot to mention I also have two, they were young when I started. They're not as young anymore, but two kids. It was a lot. I tried to approach the book with the intimacy of an insider and the distance of an outsider. There were times when I was frustrated, when I wanted to be in one place and I had to be in the other, or vice versa. But I got, it's just, you know, it cannot be said enough that librarians and archivists, and also just people who had so much information in their, you know, in their hands, but also in their attics, in their desk drawers, in unlikely places, were generous enough to share with me. So I really consider this a collaborative work. And especially when I think about the way that the living descendants of both the survivors and the perpetrators of 1898 contributed to this project. I mean, I cannot look at it as anything but a group effort.
Now, the book is just coming out. Have you gotten reaction yet? I don't know. I'm assuming that maybe you've let some people who participated see the end result. Have you heard much yet about what they think of it?
I have been really, really heartened by the early praise for the book, both in reviews and in assessments, both public, sort of in the form of jacket blurbs, and private from people whose opinions I really respect, including descendants. So it actually comes out today, Tuesday, July 14th. And I guess, I look forward to hearing from the reading public, hopefully, some of them among your listeners.
Do you think you're done with Wilmington as a subject?
I don't think I'll ever be done with Wilmington as a subject. I mean, this book is, you know, I don't want to say how many pages long it is, because then nobody will want to read it, but it's not. It's a doorstop. And the amount of material that I left on the cutting room floor, I felt it was very painful for me to give it a haircut, even to the 500 pages that it is. So no, I've got a lot to say, and I'm really, really honored to, you know, have the privilege of sharing it both with you today and with readers.
But it sounds like you are thinking of other possible ways to examine this story of Wilmington and how it reflects on America.
I don't know that I'm ready to.
Not today. You don't have to commit to anything. I just. Yeah.
But no. But I mean, what's interesting is, like, when you write a book, but then you publish it and you learn so much more about the thing that you think you could have known some stuff about. But this is when the conversations start, and I'm really looking forward to the feedback of readers. I have no doubt that the book will lead to more conversations and more questions and more encounters. And so it's always hard to feel that you've kind of put the final, the final period on the sentence. So.
Well, it's a terrific book. I can't recommend it highly enough. And it's been great speaking with you. So congratulations on the book, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Eric. It was an absolute pleasure. I really, really appreciate the invitation.
Lauren Collins is the author of They Stole a City. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.